from your friend. This baby is the result of a one-night stand with some man. I'm not letting you do this alone. He could be dangerous, Kate. We don't know. Either I go with, she says, giving me an ultimatum. Because quite often that's what B is in our relationship, the decision maker. Or you don't go. B won't be talked out of it. She's decided, and so I agree. I finish getting ready and follow B downstairs, where I sit down at the kitchen counter and research symptoms of early pregnancy on the laptop. I won't have to fake the nausea, because with Meredith and Delilah still missing, I feel constantly sick to my stomach. I can hardly keep anything down.
Meredith. 11 years before. April. Over the weekend, a client goes into labor. It's Saturday. Ordinarily, Josh would be home. But on this particular Saturday, he's entertaining clients at a Cubs game. They have a suite on the first baseline. The weather is terrible, windy and cold, but they'll be indoors. They also have access to as much food and beer as they can eat and drink. Josh asked if I minded if he went. He was excited, like a kid on Christmas Eve. How could I say no? I was hoping my client wouldn't go into labor today, not with Josh gone and the kids home with me. I need to make arrangements for them. I go to Cassandra's first. I bring the kids with me, out into the inclement weather. It's not raining, but the skies are portentous. The wind spins the hair around our heads. It's like walking into a wall. It's hard to walk at all. I grab the kids by the hand and pull them across the street. The wind tries to push us back. I could call Cassandra, but refusing in person is harder to do than over the phone. Marty answers the door. The surprise is evident. He hadn't expected to see me.
Meredith, he says, glancing down at the cold kids, then back up at me. What's up?
Josh and Cassandra know that Marty and I both went to the same college in Indiana. What they don't know is that we were friends, that we lived in the same co-ed dorm our freshman year. They also don't know that we dated, that we were hot and heavy for a while, until we weren't. Marty and I lost contact after college. He's originally from Indiana. He stayed there and attended grad school after I left. We didn't talk again after that. I didn't think we ever would. In fact, I forgot all about Marty, except for those random thoughts that come to you at random times, like how I lost my virginity to him. I thought about him mostly in terms of Delilah, knowing that one day my daughter would grow up, go to college, and discover handsome, charming, smooth-talking boys like Marty Hanaka, the kind you could never say no to. I didn't want that to happen. I wanted someone more like Josh for Delilah. Sturdy, honest, dependable. When, 10 months ago, Cassandra and Marty moved into the house across the street from ours, I couldn't believe my eyes. Marty isn't one for social media. It's not like we were Facebook friends. He isn't on Facebook at all. He could have been dead and I wouldn't have known. By the time he moved across the street, he had a master's degree and was working as a market research analyst in Chicago. He was no longer 22. Now he was 36, married, with 2 kids. I'm sorry to bother you, I say.
You're never a bother,
he says. He smiles. Marty has a way of putting me at ease. He's still just as handsome and charming as he's always been. Sometimes when we speak, it's like 14 years hasn't passed since I last saw him.
What can I do for you?
Is Cassandra home? I ask, looking past him.
There is noise and activity deeper inside the house.
She was out shopping, Marty says, but I think I just heard her come in the back door. Let me see,
he says. But he doesn't need to.
Oh, Meredith,
Cassandra says, suddenly appearing in the doorway from the kitchen. She wears a coat, but her cheeks are pink. 40 degrees and gray is much more appropriate for this time of year than the weather we've been having. Still, it comes as a blow. One step forward, two steps back. Everyone hates it, our eternal winter. Cassandra takes a look at the kids and knows exactly why I'm here.
I didn't know you were stopping by, she says. I've been out running errands. Just popped back in for a minute because I forgot a return.
As she makes her way to a coat closet, opens the door and draws out a shopping bag. Marty looks incredulous.
You're heading back out?
He asks. He looks at his watch.
I thought you'd be done by now. I told you, I need to go to the gym.
I'm embarrassed to be witness to their tiff. The kids and I still stand outside, on the stoop, freezing cold. No one has invited us in.
Yes, Cassandra says to Marty. I have a few more stops to make. It's not like I can easily do this during the week with the kids, and you're never home.
In this way, she's able to dodge my question altogether. It would be wrong of me to ask her to run her errands another day. She knows I'm not that forward. But she also knows I wouldn't leave my kids with Marty. Marty doesn't know them, and vice versa. Cassandra thinks I don't know Marty, that our encounters are limited to the rare barbecues and progressive dinners our street throws. She's wrong. It wasn't my decision not to tell Josh and Cassandra about our past. It just happened. Josh and Cassandra were right there when we first saw each other after all those years. It was last summer. Someone in the neighborhood had thrown a barbecue. Josh met them first, then brought them over to meet me. Marty thrust out a hand. He introduced himself as if he was someone I'd never met. I went along with it. I don't know why we did it that way, but we couldn't take it back after the fact.
What's Josh up to today? Cassandra asks.
I say, Cubs game.
Must be nice, she says. You and the kids didn't go?
It was for work, I say.
He should bring you and the kids along on his fun outings, she says.
I don't know how fun they are, I say. It's a lie. Josh always enjoys himself at events like this, though they're chock full of schmoozing clients. It would be a terrible place for the kids. He's working when he's there, I remind her, trying to get to know prospective clients, trying to convince prospective clients to trust him with their millions of dollars.
Of course, she says. You didn't say why you stopped by,
Cassandra remembers. Oh, I say, feeling awkward. It's not like I can ask her or Marty now to watch the kids, not after their little row. Neither of them wants to be home with their own kids. They want to be out doing things. I can't burden them with my kids, too, especially not when there's this sudden, untold strain on Cassandra and my friendship. It's about Piper, I say.
Oh?
She asks. Beside me, Delilah looks up at the mention of her friend's name.
Yes, I say. Delilah was wondering if she would like to come over for a playdate this week. We were thinking about inviting little Lily Morris, too.
Oh, yes, she says. That would be lovely.
Wonderful, I say. I'll call Amber and set a date. We leave. I go to Bea and Kate's house next. I try not to worry about whatever is going on with Cassandra. She's being snippy. But maybe it has nothing to do with me. Maybe it has something to do with her, with her marriage. If I was a better friend, I would ask her about it. I would bring baked goods and ask her if everything was all right. I will do that when things settle down and I have more time. I ring Bea and Kate's bell. Bea opens the door. Bea is a beautiful woman. She's as tall as Josh. At first glance, she seems unapproachable, but she's not at all. Bea has tattoos, too many to count. They mean things. A bird in a cage, a woman's name written in old English font. When she's had a few drinks, she tells you what they mean. The woman's name, contrary to what I first thought, is her sister, who has special needs. Bea's eyes light up when she sees Delilah and Leo.
How are my two favorite people? She asks.
Bea dresses in an effortlessly cool grunge style. I could never pull it off. If I tried, it would look all wrong on me. But not Bea. Ripped jeans, Doc Martens, a newsboy hat. At Bea's feet, Delilah giggles. She tells Bea that they are good. She's bubbly as she says it, the word mixed up in her laugh. Shy Leo says nothing, but he grins, the kind of grin that spreads to his eyes. He's happy to see Bea. Bea looks to me. What's going on? She asks. I groan. I hate to bother you, I say. Bea doesn't let me get the rest out.
You've got a client? She asks.
I say, yes. Her water just broke. She's on the way to the hospital. It's her third, so... Bea stops me there. She takes charge as Bea does. Relief overwhelms me. I admire Bea's can-do attitude. She's a problem solver. She says to the kids,
I've had my heart set on pizza for the last hour, but there was no way I can eat a pizza all by myself, and Miss Kate's at work.
She looks pleadingly at Delilah and Leo.
You think you could help me out with this?
There's nothing my kids love more in this world than pizza. Delilah screams, yes! Leo nods his head. God, Bea, I say, setting a hand on her arm. You're a lifesaver. I can't thank you enough for this. She tells me,
you'd do the same for me.
The four of us walk back to our house. Delilah and Leo gather a few of their things to bring with them. I say I'll walk them back, but Bea says no.
I've got it from here. You need to go, she says.
And I do. The phone in my pocket pings every few minutes. It's my client. She's in the passenger seat of her husband's car, texting updates. On the expressway, traffic. Give me a hug, I tell the kids. You're going to stay and play with Miss Bea today. The kids do as they're told. Bea grabs them each by a hand and leaves. Leo has no qualms in getting left with Bea. He goes with her willingly, without a backward glance in my direction. It's telling. Something about Charlotte's house has him spooked. Seeing Leo with Bea warms my heart. I feel at peace, watching him walk voluntarily away, blue blankie dragging through the grass. The birth is quick. My client nearly delivers without me. Sometimes this happens. As I'm leaving, Josh calls. He's on his way home from the baseball game.
Oh, he says. I didn't think you'd answer. I was going to leave a message.
Why's that? I ask, wondering why he didn't think I'd answer his call.
You're at a birth, he says.
I find my car in the hospital's parking garage. I get in and lock the doors. I keep my eyes peeled to the rearview mirror. I don't like not knowing what's behind me, if anyone is there. Just leaving, I say. I start the car and shift into reverse, glad to be moving. How did you know? I ask. I would think that he's spoken to B, except that if Josh didn't know I was at a birth, he wouldn't have called B. Unless B called him for something, I think, hoping the kids are all right.
The app, he says. I see that you're at the hospital.
Oh, I say. Right. His words leave me feeling exposed, like someone is watching me. Because he is. I picture Josh looking at the app on his phone. I picture the little thumbnail image of my own face on the map. I imagine it moving as I leave the parking garage and pull out onto the street. Josh all the while watching. I ask Josh about the baseball game and what time he'll be home. He'll be there sooner than me. He'll get the kids from B. We say our goodbyes and Josh tells me,
drive carefully.
I end the call. I'm driving through the intersection when my phone pings the arrival of a new text. I shouldn't look when I'm driving, but I do. It's from the same 630 number that's been sending me threatening texts. Just seeing the number strikes terror into me. I pull over into the parking lot of a golf course. My hands are shaking too much to drive. But also, I want to read the text without distraction. For a second, I think of Josh. I picture him staring at the app on his phone, wondering why I've pulled off the road and into the parking lot. Does the app show enough detail for that? I take a deep breath. I warily read the text. I hope you haven't forgotten about me, because I haven't forgotten about you. The emoji this time is the face screaming in fear.
Kate, 11 years before. May. Dr. Feingold's office is located on the third floor of a medical professional building that sits adjacent to the hospital. The building itself is modern, full of natural lighting and glass. In the lobby, there's a line waiting for the elevator, and so Bea and I take the stairs to the third floor. We say very little as we ascend the steep steps, conserving our breath for the climb. But I can tell from Bea's silence that she wishes I'd change my mind. I'm dead set on this. I've decided this is something I need to do. When we reach the third floor, we walk side by side down the hall. As we close in on Dr. Feingold's office, Bea finally asks, "What do you hope to get out of this?" Her words embittered and disapproving. She sets a hand on my arm and forces me to stop, to look at her, and I do. I can't put it into words what I hope to gain without it sounding ignorant, and so I say nothing. In my silence, Bea asks, "You think he's just going to come right out and tell you he did something to Meredith?" "No," I say, shaking my head. "Of course not." "Then what?" she asks.
"You're going to ask him?"
"Of course not," I say again, trying to explain that what I'm hoping for isn't a confession, but rather a hunch, some gut reaction, an inner voice telling me that Dr. Feingold did something to our friend. When we come to it, the waiting room is small but inviting. A receptionist takes my name. She hands me some forms and tells us to have a seat. "The nurse," she says, "will be with us shortly." I fill out the forms while I wait. I write down my name and address. Bea glances down at the paperwork as I do. She nudges me hard.
"What are you doing?"
she hisses beneath her breath, seeing that I've just left my real name and address. Bea rarely gets angry at me. But this isn't anger. Our eyes meet, and I see in them that Bea is scared. She's worried I'm getting in over my head like Meredith did. And now Meredith's gone.
I didn't think a fake name and address were necessary. It's not like someone of Dr. Feingold's pay grade deals with paperwork. But clearly B thinks it is. Go get another form. Start over, she says. But it's too late for that because, a breath later, the door opens and a nurse comes for me, calling out my name into the waiting room. Here, I say, standing, and the nurse smiles at B on her chair, thinking B will stay in the waiting room and wait. But instead, B stands. Oh, the nurse says. Your friend can come too if you'd like. Yes, please. The baby's father, I say, couldn't be here. I try my best to stay calm. I focus on breathing. Even though it feels like the truth is obvious, Dr. Feingold and his staff have no reason to believe my intentions for being here are anything but genuine. As far as they know, I'm an ecstatic new mom to be. And so I slap a silly grin on my face and follow the nurse back into the exam room, where I go blathering on and on about the pregnancy and the new baby and how excited I am to be a mom. I ask the nurse questions. Twins, I tell her, run in my family. Is it possible it's twins? How soon would we know? She humors me. Maybe, she says, asking who in the family has twins and whether my husband and I would be happy with news like that. Of course, I say. Who wouldn't be thrilled? I tell her I've always wanted a large family. Some women aren't, she says. She looks down at my hand when she says, husband. I don't wear a wedding ring. B and I aren't married. Not yet, though we have high hopes that one day soon gay marriage will be legal in our state. We talked about going somewhere else to get married. Massachusetts, maybe. But something about it didn't feel right if our marriage wasn't going to be recognized or accepted once we were back home. What I do wear is a promise ring. It's dainty and thin. Some discerning person might see that B wears the same thing, a silver band with a delicate knot. We picked them out together, with a promise that when we could, we would get married. It might be too soon to detect multiples by ultrasound, she says. But Dr. Feingold is the expert. He'll know. She takes my vitals. She asks for information, like the date of my last menstrual period, which I know because I did my research and knew this is something she would ask. I give a fabricated date, one that would make sense with me being newly pregnant, approximately 5 or 6 weeks along. At her request, I go to the bathroom and leave a urine sample. When I come back, the nurse is gone. A paper gown sits on the exam table for me. I change into it. B and I wait for the doctor to come. It isn't too late, B says, as I situate myself on the table, staring down at the stirrups, feeling sick to my stomach. I don't know how this is going to go. I don't know what to anticipate. But I also don't know how much it matters. Before too long, the nurse will run the urine sample I've left for her. She'll figure out I'm not pregnant. My time with the doctor will be short. Before he delivers the bad news, I feign sadness and B and I leave. But at least I'll get my eyes on him before that happens. We can still go, B says. We don't have to do this. And what would we say? I ask, thinking it would look strange if we were to suddenly leave. That there's been a family emergency. But leaving isn't an option for me. Not until I've seen and spoken to him. We've come this far. I close my eyes. I take a deep breath. It will all be over in a few minutes. Nothing, I say, will go wrong. As far as he knows, I'm just another pregnant woman. Try and act normal, I tell her. There are magazines on a countertop. I tell her to pick one and pretend to read. The knock on the exam room door is ungentle. Two quick cracks, and then he lets himself in. My own gynecologist opens it an inch before calling into the room and asking if I'm dressed. Only then, when I tell her I am, does she come in. But Dr. Feingold doesn't wait. He stands in the doorway, stern but smiling, the kind of smile that doesn't reach his eyes. It's insincere. He's a tall man. He wears a white doctor smock over a pair of gray pants and a collared shirt. He's about the age I pictured him to be, based on Jeanette's description of him. She said that he was uncompromising. This made him older in my mind. Old school. Someone who's been around the block a few times and is set in his ways. He's probably 65, thinking about retirement, about becoming a snowbird, not wanting the Tebow's malpractice case to be the low note he ends his career on. Dr. Feingold's hair is graying and thin. He himself is thin.
Dr. Feingold,
he says.
And who do we have here?
He asks, meaning me, and it upsets me already that he doesn't know my name, that he didn't bother to look before coming into the room. He's businesslike, clinical. My gynecologist is warm. I can't say with any certainty that she remembers me from year to year, but she's never given me a reason to think she doesn't. She sits down on her stool and chats a while before starting her exam. She asks about my family. She asks about me. It's like we're old friends. Even as a vet, I let dogs sniff me before I start an exam. It's our way of getting to know one another before I touch them. I tell him, I'm Kate, and this is my friend Bee. Bee sits on her chair. Her discomfort is palpable to me, though I'm not sure he notices, because he never looks at Bee. Her hands are folded together on her lap, and she's clutching them so tightly that the skin has turned white. Bee hates the lack of control.
So you say you're pregnant,
he says. He sees pregnant women every day. There's nothing remarkable about it. Not for him, but for a first-time mom, it's miraculous. I try to remember this, to remember to be ecstatic, not scared. I am, I say, beaming. I took 3 of those home pregnancy tests. I tell him, elated, because any other woman in my position, having peed on 3 sticks and saw a total of 6 pink lines, would never have a reason to believe she wasn't pregnant.
And?
He prompts about the home pregnancy tests.
All positive,
I say with a grin, setting a hand on my abdomen. He looks skeptically at me.
All of them?
He asks, eyes narrowing. Yes, sir, I say, shifting my eager demeanor. My smile melts away and I ask, is there a problem? Because he's given me reason to believe there is. I go with it. He says,
the test we ran was negative.
Silence falls over the room. He doesn't say he's sorry. In no way does he apologize for the bad news. He doesn't break it to me lightly. He stands, watching me, waiting for me to say something in reply. I don't understand, I say after a while, claiming ignorance and shock. My voice trembles because I'm scared. It has the desired effect. But the tests I took at home, I say, letting my voice drift, letting the doctor infer what comes next. He's dispassionate. He lectures.
Sometimes we have what's called a chemical pregnancy, an early miscarriage shortly after implantation. So soon, in fact, that women often assume it's that time of the month,
he says, which strikes me as both an archaic saying and a chauvinistic one. I dated a boy in high school before coming to terms with my sexuality. All I had to do was be in a bad mood, and he assumed it was that time of the month. He'd badger me about it. Once, after a fight, he gifted me with a box of Tampax. It's just a joke, Kate, he said when I broke up with him over it. Can't you take a little joke?
These women never know they're pregnant,
Dr. Feingold says.
This could be the reason your home pregnancy tests were positive.
He asks if I had any bleeding following the home pregnancy tests, any spotting. I shake my head vigorously. I say, no.
We'll do a blood test to know for certain.
He tells me a blood test can tell us exactly how much HCG is in my system, if any. He tells me only pregnant women's bodies make HCG.
No HCG, no baby,
he says, just like that. He shrugs as he says it, as if what we're discussing is something far less consequential than a life. It doesn't matter that my baby is fictional, that my baby never did exist. That doesn't make it okay, because to another woman, this moment means everything.
I wouldn't worry yet,
he says. And though the words themselves are heartening in nature, meant to put me at ease, the delivery is anything but. His words fall flat. There's no encouraging smile, not even a fake one. What Dr. Feingold wants, I think, is to forestall any emotion, for me to cry later, at home, alone, because crying is messy. It's not his cup of tea.
The blood test,
he tells me.
Get sent to the lab. Results will be back in a couple of days. Soon as the exam is through, I'll send the nurse back in for the blood. Now let's take a look,
he says, motioning for me to lie back on the exam table. My breath catches. Under my arms, I begin to sweat. I know that a pap smear and a pelvic exam are routine during a first prenatal appointment. I came across that when I did my research in preparation for the appointment. But I hadn't expected it to get so far. With the pregnancy now nearly debunked, there is no reason for Dr. Feingold to do this until after the blood work, until after we know for certain if I'm pregnant, which I'm not. The thought of this man touching me, of his fingers inside me, makes me nauseous. I think of Shelby being murdered, of her naked body dragged to the riverbank and abandoned there. Did this man do that to her? Shouldn't we wait for the results of the blood work? I ask. Only then does he smile. It's supercilious, predatory.
If I'm going to be your doctor,
he says,
you need to trust me. Okay, Katie?
He asks, and I mechanically nod, speechless, not able to correct his blunder. I've never been a Katie or a Catherine. I've only ever been known as Kate. It's the name my parents gave to me, not the diminutive form of something else.
There are changes to the uterus when a woman is pregnant. These can sometimes be detected during a pelvic exam,
he says by rote. And though I know he won't feel these changes, any mother-to-be, I think, would do whatever he asked to know if she was pregnant. Any mother-to-be in my position would be desperate for confirmation of the pregnancy. What choice do I have? I go to lie back, but then I stop myself. I sit back up, propping myself on my elbows. I have questions to ask, and if I'm going to ask them, I need to ask them now. As soon as Dr. Feingold completes his exam and comes back with the bad news, I'm not pregnant, my questions will be moot. No baby, no need for a baby doctor. A friend of mine, I say, speaking quickly now, letting my nerves get the best of me. A different friend, not this one, I say about B. She had a baby recently. It was awful, I say. The labor was long. The nursing staff went through 3 shift changes while she was in labor. She saw 3 different doctors from her medical practice in that time. It was impersonal, not at all what she imagined about giving birth to her first child. In retrospect, she wishes she had hired a doula, someone who was there only for her. If she had to do it all over again, she would have hired one, she said. What are your thoughts, I come out and ask, on doulas? Dr. Feingold steps back to the wall. There, he reaches inside a box for a pair of latex gloves. He returns, standing before me, sliding the gloves onto his hands. I don't see a doctor with gloves. I see a murderer hiding fingerprints. My heart beats hard. Dr. Feingold says,
unlike your friend's obstetric practice, I'm the only doctor here. If you're pregnant, I will be the one delivering your baby. You can count on that. In my experience, with the right doctor,
he says,
a doula is unnecessary.
Oh, I say, trying to mask my shaky voice. I could be done there. I could let it go. But there's more to say. That surprises me, I tell him. Because I've been doing research into doulas, just in case, you know, just in case I am pregnant. I've been reading blog posts and stuff. Reviews. Some women really rave about the support and assistance hiring a doula can provide, he says.
Doulas can be very expensive,
I say. I've done the math. I think I can afford a doula. Dr. Feingold smiles, but he says nothing. I ask B to pass me my bag, and reluctantly she does. She doesn't know what I've done. I reach a hand inside my bag. I draw out a slip of paper where I've written names down. I hold the list out to Dr. Feingold. He takes it from me and has a look. These were a few local doulas whose names I kept coming across in my research, I say. There are three names on the list. Chloe Nord, Christine Frank, and Meredith Dickey. All three are local doulas. All three are spoken of highly on local moms' Facebook groups and would be the kind of women I'd look for if I was pregnant and seeking a doula. I refuse to turn and look at B, knowing she's likely pissed. She'll tell me this was too risky, that I went too far, bringing Meredith's name up, that I crossed a line. But I'm so close. I can't let it go. I ask Dr. Feingold, if I did decide to hire a doula, would you recommend any of these women? Dr. Feingold takes a long look. He thinks, and I appreciate the attention he gives it, though I don't think for a minute he's being sincere. He's thinking before he speaks, being extra cautious. He doesn't want to say the wrong thing. He tells me,
if you felt the need to hire a doula, he says, with the emphasis on if. Either of the first two would be good. But this Dickey one, he says, tapping at the paper with his hand,
and I think he's going to trash talk Meredith at first.
Meredith Dickey, he says. I don't know her.
Before passing the list back to me and getting on with his exam. He's lying. A bald-faced lie. He does know Meredith. Dr. Feingold tells me again to lie down on the table. It's stern the way he says it this time. Subconsciously, I clutch the plackets of my robe together. My mouth tastes suddenly metallic. I lie down flat and defensive on the exam table, pressing my knees together. B sits unconsciously forward in her chair. The doctor, noticing this, says,
if you'd rather, your friend can wait outside.
It isn't such an odd thing to say. If she was my friend, my platonic friend, I wouldn't want her to see me naked. This would be awkward, be in such close proximity during a pelvic exam. This is awkward. But the idea of Dr. Feingold and me alone, with me naked, his hands inside me, makes my flesh crawl. B can't leave. My memory is rubbish, I say, swallowing hard and scared, voice trembling. I can no longer control it. I asked her to come along to remember all the things I'd forget to ask. She has three kids, I say. She knows a thing or two about being pregnant. This is my first, I tell him, voice diminishing as I say it, taking on the somber tone of a woman who may or may not have miscarried. B shifts her chair in another direction and looks away. Dr. Feingold motions for me to slide to the end of the exam table and stick my feet in the stirrups. I do, lying spread eagle on the table before him. Dr. Feingold sets his firm hands on my bare knees. He presses my legs wider before dropping somewhere that I can't see. I'm flat on my back. I can't see what he's doing. I close my eyes, try and transport myself somewhere far from here. My own gynecologist talks me through the entire exam, as if every time is the first time. A little pressure, she forewarns. Just try and relax for me, Kate. You'll hear a click. But Dr. Feingold doesn't speak. Before I can process what's happening, his cold speculum is inside me, blades clicking open, and I gasp, not ready for the pressure of it, for the pain. Dr. Feingold moves fast, shifting the cold metal to get a good look inside me. My eyes fly open and I bite down hard on my lower lip, tasting blood. Before I can catch my breath from the sudden plunge of the speculum, it's out, gone, replaced with his invasive hand, and he's feeling around, groping, another hand applying pressure to the outside of me, to my abdomen. It's routine for him, automatic, but it's awful for me, unbearable. Knowing these hands are the hands of a killer makes the heat rush to my face. I think again of Shelby's body there at the riverbank, dead for days. This man may have stolen a life. He may have left a helpless infant without a mother. There's a sudden ringing in my ears, a blackness spreading from the periphery of my vision so that I think I could pass out. My legs close against my will, and Dr. Feingold tells me sharply to open back up, that the more still I sit, as if I'm a 4-year-old having a dental cleaning, the quicker he will be done. "Everything okay, Kate?" B asks as tears prick my eyes and I force them back. I mumble an affirmation. I can't see her from my vantage point, but I hear the fear and disgust in her voice, same as in mine. When he's done, he pulls his hand abruptly from me, and he tells me to sit up.
"The blood test,"
he says flatly,
"will be more definitive."
"What does that mean?" I ask, struggling to sit up, clutching the robe together at the chest and lap. Dr. Feingold's eyes go there, to my hands, which are shaking.
"It may be too soon to see any changes in the uterus,"
he says. "So you didn't see any changes? I'm not pregnant then?" I ask. "You think I miscarried? Or you think the home pregnancy tests were wrong?" I don't have to simulate the fear, the shock, the disgust. It's already there.
"The nurse will be in to do blood work," he tells me. "I'm not into speculating. I prefer things to be conclusive. Let's see what we learn from the blood work and figure out where to go from there. You might want to hold off on interviewing doulas until we know more,"
he says as he leaves.
Meredith, 11 years before. April. Shelby Tebow goes into labor 2 weeks early. The call comes in the middle of the night. It's Jason who calls from Shelby's phone. Her contractions are close. I tell him to go to the hospital. I say that I will meet them there. I meet Jason for the first time. He's everything I expected him to be, except that his voice, now that I hear it, is not the same one I heard when I was standing outside their home. That was another man. It calls everything I know about Shelby Tebow into question. Shelby gets examined first by a triage nurse to see if she'll be admitted or sent home. The suggestion of going back home gets Jason provoked, though it's standard protocol to be examined before being admitted. Jason gets angry with the triage nurse. "You need to simmer down, sir," she tells him. He stands too close, breathing down her neck as she examines Shelby. The nurse tells him to back away and give her room. She examines Shelby, who is 5 centimeters dilated. Her contractions are less than 4 minutes apart. Shelby gets admitted. She changes into a hospital gown and takes her place in the bed. In time, Dr. Feingold comes. I've never had the pleasure of working with Dr. Feingold before, but his reputation precedes him. He's overweening and uncompromising. He tries to relegate me to the corner of the room. I won't have it. Shelby is my client as much as she is his. He wants to check her progress. He jams his fingers inside her cervix, far less gently than the triage nurse. Shelby recoils on the hospital bed. She presses her knees together. She tries pulling away from him.
"You need to hold still," he says.
It's apathetic. "You're hurting me," she whimpers. He makes light of her pain.
"This doesn't hurt,"
he says, going on. He wouldn't know. He's never had a cervical exam before. Shelby squirms. He tells her to hold still. He says that the more still she holds, the sooner he will be done. It's denigrating.
"All done,"
Dr. Feingold says to Shelby as he yanks the latex glove from his hand.
"Now that wasn't so bad, was it?"
She won't look at him.
Dr. Feingold doesn't use electronic fetal monitoring to continuously monitor the baby's heart. Instead, he listens with a Doppler device. Many obstetricians do. Electronic fetal monitoring isn't necessary for everyone, unless they're high risk. But intermittent auscultation is exactly that. Intermittent. And requires diligence on the part of Dr. Feingold and the labor nurse. Tonight, the hospital is busy. Many women are in labor, including another of Dr. Feingold's patients. The nurse says, "Must be a full moon." There's no truth in that. It's only folklore. Changes in barometric pressure can cause women to go into labor, but not full moons. It's more likely there's a storm coming than that there's a full moon. Dr. Feingold steps out of the room. Before he leaves, he asks me to step out into the hall with him. He says to me privately, as if we're in cahoots about this,
"You've got your work cut out for you with this one."
He's smirking as he asks,
"Is this what they mean when they say attention whore?"
I'm so shocked that at first I don't speak. I just stare, wide-eyed and slack-jawed. "My clients," I tell him when I catch my breath, "are always looking for OB recommendations. I wouldn't recommend you to anyone, doctor." If I had personal experience with Dr. Feingold before, I would have told Shelby to run in the other direction. I have a growing list of doctors I won't work with, of hospitals I won't go to. He'd just been added to my list. He believes his medical degree gives him carte blanche. It doesn't. Once he's gone, I return to Shelby's side. She tells me, "I hate him." "Don't worry about Dr. Feingold," I say. "Just think of your beautiful baby and the life you'll share. You're almost through, Shelby." Within an hour, a nurse comes in to check Shelby's progress. "Already?" I ask when she tells me what she's here to do. It seems too soon for another cervical check. "Dr. Feingold wants to know." She goes to Shelby. "Let's have a look-see," she says. She motions for Shelby to bend her knees and open up. Shelby does as she's told. She doesn't know that she can say no. She doesn't know what I know. There isn't any good research that says cervical exams are absolutely necessary during labor. They're also not 100% accurate. One person's measurements are not the same as the next, and they need not be done every hour. "Are you okay, Shelby?" I ask, my hand in the way to prevent the nurse from touching my client without her consent. "Is it okay with you if the nurse checks your cervix? That's when they see how far dilated you are. That's what Dr. Feingold did a little while ago when he was here," I say. "Because informed consent is important. A person should know what they're saying yes to." Shelby draws backward on the bed. She whimpers. "Is it going to hurt as much as last time?" "It might," I say. "And it might not. It's your call, Shelby. If you don't want the nurse to check, she won't," I tell her as the nurse pulls a face. Shelby thinks about it. She decides. She looks to me and there's an inappreciable shake of the head. "Not now," she says. "Not if I don't have to." "It's been barely an hour," I say to the nurse. "It's too soon for another check." The nurse leaves. She's not happy with me. Shelby asks, "What if she doesn't come back?" This is the problem. Laboring women don't want to piss anyone off because they need them, which means that sometimes unnecessary things are done to a woman's body during labor for the sake of convenience or efficiency. Sometimes I'm as much of a bodyguard as anything else. I promise her, she'll come back. Shelby doesn't handle the contractions well. Her threshold for pain isn't high. I sit with her. I try and help her breathe through them, but she's too beside herself to breathe. She asks for her epidural. The anesthesiologist is called, but he's not immediately available. What Shelby wants is immediate relief, but she has to wait.
What the fuck is taking so long?
Jason asks. He paces the room. I ask him to calm down. I tell him quietly that he's not helping anything by getting upset. He needs to be a calming presence for Shelby's sake. The epidural comes. Jason is asked to leave for the placement of it. This makes him irate. I go with him. In the hall, I try to explain that it's a sterile procedure, a catheter being inserted directly into Shelby's epidural space. It's also a liability. Fathers are notorious for passing out at the sight of needles. It takes longer than expected because Shelby won't hold still. This sends Jason off the deep end. I have to physically restrain him to keep him from going back into the labor room. The epidural slows Shelby's progression. What was quick is now slow. The relief, though, is immediate. She nearly goes numb from the waist down. I sit on the edge of the hospital bed beside her. I push the hair from her eyes. I offer her ice chips and a massage. She declines both, preferring sleep. Sleep is a good idea. She needs her rest. As she sleeps, Jason Tebow talks to me. He's cynical, hostile. He swears a lot. But maybe he's not the monster my imagination made him out to be. There's a softer side to him. He's tender toward Shelby. It's endearing. I can see that, though he has a temper, he loves her dearly. As she sleeps, Jason moves to the edge of the bed. He watches her. He strokes her head. He holds her hand. He tells me,
"My father was never around. He left when I was 5, got remarried, had another kid. For a few years, I'd get a present at Christmas and on my birthday. After that, nothing."
The look on his face is melancholic.
"I'm going to do better for my kid," he promises.
"I'm sure you will," I say. He reaches out, touches Shelby's abdomen.
"I'd give my kid the world if I could."
I tell him, "I believe you would."
"Can I tell you something?"
he asks. "Of course," I say.
"I think Shelby's going to leave me. I think she's going to take my kid away with her when she goes."
"Why would she do that?" I ask. I shouldn't have asked. I regret it as soon as I do. It's none of my business. I shouldn't let myself get drawn into their marriage.
"She's cheating on me,"
he says.
"I know she is."
I know this too. At least, I think I do. There was a man in their home the day I stopped by. He stood at the top of the stairs beckoning for Shelby to come. Shelby was desperate for me to leave. It wasn't so that Jason wouldn't see me and get upset. It was so that she could get back to her man. This makes me see Shelby in a different light. Their marriage is far from perfect. But it's not all on Jason, I don't think. They're both responsible for this. I consider the things she suggested about him, the conclusion I drew, that he was hurting her. Was there any truth to that, or was she laying the groundwork for divorce? Things like child custody and alimony would be affected if a judge thought Jason has been abusive toward her. A claim of domestic abuse would swing the balance in Shelby's favor. But I'm only theorizing. There's no way to know for sure. I can't stop myself. How do you know? She told you?
She didn't have to,
he says. He says that he just knows. Have you talked to her about it? I ask. He shakes his head. He looks at me. His eyes are a mix of angry and sad. He's sullen. He says,
I know how it is. When people get divorced, the mother always keeps the baby. Shelby can't ever take my baby from me.
Fathers have rights too, I tell him. But he isn't wrong. Custody is almost always granted to the mother. He says,
every other weekend isn't good enough for me.
Give it time, Jason. Talk to her. Maybe you're wrong. Pregnancy is hard. You might have misread the situation. Maybe it's the hormones making her distant, not some other guy.
I'm not a fucking idiot,
he says. I swallow hard. His quick temper makes me nervous. I lower my voice and move physically away, though I've not yet seen him be physical, only verbal in his assaults. I didn't say you are.
She's cheating on me,
he says.
And there's no way in hell that if and when she decides to leave me, I'm letting her take my baby away.
Later, Shelby wakes. The nurse comes in to check on her. Her dilation and effacement haven't changed much. We wait a while longer. When Shelby fails to progress, the doctor orders Pitocin. This strengthens her contractions. Soon, Shelby is in pain. Jason wants to know why.
The fucking epidural isn't working. Shouldn't she be numb? He asks.
Even with the epidural, the pressure can become more intense as time goes on.
Call the doctor. Get him to fix it, he says.
We need her to feel the pressure of the contractions now. It will help Shelby push your baby out, I say. And then I turn my back to him. My energy needs to be spent comforting Shelby, not mollifying him. We try again to work on her breathing, but Shelby is too far gone for that. When she's reached 10 centimeters, the nurse has Shelby labor down for a while before she starts to push, in the hopes that the uterus and contractions will do some of the work for her. But the contractions are unbearable. There's the greatest desire to bear down. When it's time to push, I talk to Shelby about breathing, about effective pushing. When she screams at me that she can't do it, I tell her that she already is. You're doing it, Shelby. You are doing it. I smile encouragingly. When Jason looks like he might be sick, I suggest he step out into the hall for air. He does as I say. After a few minutes, he comes back. I feed Shelby ice chips during each push. She pushes a long while. First-time mothers who've had an epidural tend to push anywhere up to 3 hours, sometimes more, which is fine so long as the mother and baby aren't in distress or the mother too exhausted to push. By the time Dr. Feingold returns, Shelby is completely spent. What his patients like about Dr. Feingold is that he's a solo practitioner. He's not part of a big group. There's comfort in that. When his patients deliver, they know just exactly what they'll get. The other groups have upward of 10 obstetricians on staff. When it comes to delivery, you might get one you like. You might get one you don't like. You might get one you've never seen before. That prospect worries many. That's why they settle for a no-nonsense man like Dr. Feingold. With him, there are few, if any, unknowns. He's been doing this for decades. The first thing Dr. Feingold says to her is,
"The better you push, the sooner you'll be done."
That's not necessarily true. It's also patronizing. That the baby doesn't move despite Shelby's pushing isn't her fault.
I can't do it,
Shelby cries out. The sweat drips from her hairline. It rolls down her cheek.
Get this baby out of me, she screams.
Jason, beside me, is incensed. I pull Dr. Feingold aside and suggest that Shelby can't do this, that she's had enough. Shelby doesn't have any real qualms in having a cesarean. It's not her first choice, but she's fine having one if necessary. And to me, taking her exhaustion into account, the prolonged labor, the fact that things have stalled, it seems necessary, prudent even. Dr. Feingold is dismissive of my concerns.
I'm the doctor,
he reminds me, loud enough that everyone in the room can hear. He glares at me as he says it.
I've been in practice for 30-odd years. Why don't you let me decide how this is going to go, unless you have some medical degree that I don't know about?
He walks away from me. He returns to Shelby.
Besides,
he tells her, as if he was talking to her all along,
a C-section will leave you with an ugly scar, and no one wants that.
A healthy baby. That was Shelby's only request when we discussed her birth plan. Instead of a C-section, Dr. Feingold decides to use forceps to help get the baby out. Very few doctors use them anymore. Mostly only old-school ones like Dr. Feingold. The use of forceps poses a potential risk. Dr. Feingold doesn't discuss these risks with Shelby or Jason. He only tells her what she wants to hear, that he's going to help get this baby out of her now. But that's not all. Because Shelby isn't allowed the opportunity to give informed consent before he cuts an episiotomy, using a pair of scissors to cut her perineum instead of having it tear on its own, if at all. An episiotomy should be an exception these days, not the norm, and it should always come with a clear explanation of the possible complications, of which there are many, from painful sex to fecal incontinence. I'm appalled. Doctor, I say tersely. But it's too late. Because it's done. He glares at me over my client, where I stand by her side, trying to comfort her.
Would you like to wait in the hall?
He asks. I don't move. He doesn't look at Shelby when he speaks to her.
I'm going to get this baby out of you. Sound good?
Shelby unleashes a scream with the next contraction. Dr. Feingold finds humor in it.
I'll take that as a yes,
he says arrogantly. It makes me irate. The absence of a no should never mean yes. I've worked hard to create a culture of consent with my clients, especially in situations like this, where Shelby is vulnerable and Dr. Feingold in a position of power. There are risks in all manners of delivery. I know that. But a woman should be made aware of these risks. She should be given the opportunity to weigh the options for herself. I see Dr. Feingold preparing the forceps for use. I won't be silenced. There are possible complications to using forceps to aid in delivery, Shelby, I say, speaking quickly, urgently. I stand at the side of the bed, leaned into her. I look in her eyes. Shelby is completely spent. The exhaustion is tangible. She'd do anything for this delivery to be through. The worst being brain damage, skull fracture, death. You should know this before... Dr. Feingold cuts me off.
Your doula,
he says smugly, degradingly,
has no medical training. Are you going to listen to her? Or me.
Another contraction racks Shelby.
Just get this baby out of me,
she screams. screams. Dr. Feingold takes that for consent. He applies forceps to the baby's head. He uses the forceps to first turn the baby's head. With the next contraction, he instructs Shelby to push as he drags the baby out. As he does, Shelby screams in excruciating pain, despite the epidural, as if she's being torn in two. The baby doesn't cry when she arrives. My first thought is that she won't survive.
Kate, 11 years before. May.
You should have told me you were going to ask about Meredith.
Bea shouts at me as we make our way across the parking lot and toward the car. The rain is coming down hard, the parking lot riddled with puddles that we step into, sending rainwater everywhere, soaking our legs and feet. We use whatever we can to keep ourselves marginally dry. Bea has slipped out of a jacket and holds it over her head. I use my tote bag, though it's canvas and doesn't do much to fend off the rain. The rain leaks through. I get wet anyway, despite the bag. The medical building backs up to an expressway. Traffic is heavy and loud. The fact that it's raining again only compounds the problem. The rain is as loud as the street traffic. The streets are wet. People tend to drive like idiots when the streets are wet, meaning that every few seconds someone lays on their horn. Bea isn't shouting at me, though she is angry. She's shouting over the noise.
Why?
I shout back as we reach the car. Bea and I part ways. Me going to the driver's side where I open the door and slide quickly in before the rain has a chance to follow me. My body is sore from the exam. I feel dirty, sick. I want nothing more than to go home, to shower, change, wash Dr. Feingold's hands from me. On the other side of the car, Bea slips into the passenger seat, slamming the door closed. She turns to me and says,
"So I could have talked you out of it. You told me you just wanted to get eyes on him, Kate. You didn't tell me you were going to ask about Meredith."
She pauses for breath. "He isn't a nice man," she says, which I know. Even if he hasn't killed Shelby or done something to Meredith, he still wouldn't be a nice man. He's arrogant, insensitive, abrasive. I turn on the car and begin to drive. Rain pours down from the sky. The wipers whip back and forth across the glass. They can't keep up with the downpour. I have trouble seeing out the windshield as I pull out of the parking lot and into the street. I cut it too close, cutting off another car. The driver lays on their horn for a prolonged period of time, putting me even more on edge than I was to begin with. Usually, I'd step on the gas and pull away, but I can't with the streets as wet as they are. It takes time for us to pick up speed.
"Careful, Kate," Bea scolds.
"That was close." The other car switches lanes and speeds around us, inconvenienced and apparently immune to the weather. The window is all fogged up. I rub at the glass with the sleeve of a shirt, clearing a semicircle out of which I just barely see. I turn on both the rear and the front defrost.
"I didn't tell you," I say to Bea, "because I knew what you'd say."
"And what's that?" she asks. She tosses her wet jacket into the back seat.
"You tell me not to go through with it."
"You're damn right," she says. "The man is in the middle of a malpractice suit. Meredith is a witness. She was going to expose him. Regardless of what's happened to Shelby or Meredith, you think bringing her name up wouldn't tip him off to something? He knows where we live, Kate," she says.
"He knows because you told him. You wrote it down on those forms.
If he figures out we're Meredith's next-door neighbors, he'll think we're colluding with her."
"But you saw his reaction,"
I ask. Fighting through the fog to see, I lean forward in my seat, gazing out that 4-inch circle that gradually grows, but not quickly enough for me. I consider pulling over, waiting the deluge out. But more than anything, I want to be home, behind a locked door. I need a shower. I need clean, dry clothes. It's cold in the car, and I'm drenched to the bone.
"You saw how he responded when I asked about Meredith, didn't you? He lied, Bea. He said he'd never heard of her when he has. Why would he lie if he hasn't done something to her?"
"I don't know. But listen," Bea says, her tone softening so that she's hard to hear over the pelting rain, which isn't only rain now, but hail. It stabs at the hood of the car like knives. It's time we stop being amateur sleuths and let the police handle this. We're in over our heads, she says, sounding scared. B is the strong one, my fearless leader. I've never known B to be scared.